Hello, and good day to you from episode 6 of our podcast series, Project Breakaway, a metaphorical and literal time in the day when we here at Predator Cycling take some time away from working in the back shop to come and share with our listeners what we're doing, how we're doing it, what it takes to do it, our ideas, our innovative success stories, and even our missteps and failures. If you find yourself with an interest in bicycles, composite manufacturing, out-of-the-box design, or even curiosities beyond, I encourage you to stick with us, settle in, and learn a little. I'm Courtney B., co-owner and project manager of Predator Cycling, and I'm here with my partner, Aram Goganian, the other co-owner, CEO, lead designer and engineer, and Mandalorian expert of Predator Cycling. How's it going, Aram?
Good. I like the Mandalorian.
I don't know if you're an expert, but you seem to be watching a lot of it.
Not really. I got an episode in yesterday.
Yeah. I think Baby Yoda is cute, but I really have no interest in watching it.
It's okay. You don't have the best of taste in shows.
Yeah, I do, but let's move on. So, Aram.
For another day's topic.
Yeah. The podcast is a little later this week. We've just been super busy working on some marketing campaigns that we're going to unveil here at the end of the month. So we thought we'd get back to it today.
Yeah, so a little delayed.
Yes, delayed, but we're here. So in relation to last week's topic of our new road frame, the RF20, we got a lot of emails and messages asking about more technical details that aren't yet available on the website. So people were asking, what kind of carbon we use on the frame, what was the weave of the carbon and epoxy systems used, how did we do our layups, how strong is the frame, where are the strength points. So I think on this episode, I really want to discuss carbon fiber.
Yep.
So let's start from the beginning. What is carbon fiber?
So carbon fiber is it's two separate components that are brought together to make a laminate. So in carbon fiber for bicycles, and what we're talking about a matrix and a reinforcement fabric. So in most cases, the matrix we're talking about is a epoxy-based system or sometimes a proset. It's mostly vinyl ester-based epoxies, vinyl ester-based products. It's not an epoxy. And then on the fabric reinforcement side, you're talking about, in most cases, carbon fiber, but you could also be including things like Kevlar, you could be looking at fiberglass, e-glass, and even there's other support materials that you can be using in that. So when those materials are put together, that gives you a composite product, or it's called in the industry a laminate.
And it's essentially a fabric. I don't think a lot of people realize it's like a draping of fabric.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it is. It's like cotton shirt that you're wearing. Obviously, the stitch pattern is a little different and the material is different,
right.
But it's essentially the same thing.
And if you think of a fabric, just how hard it is to lay and create angles, mm-hmm. because I'm trying to think of the word, it's not in my head right now, but to make an angle, you know, when you're folding something, you have to create like a crease, so you create like a little triangle and stuff. It's very hard to lay up.
It can get
especially in the shape of a bicycle.
Yeah. Especially that kind of goes back to the idea of what makes the RF20 so difficult is that it's a very organic shape, so it makes it very difficult to lay up. And that was it's one of the reasons it's taken us so long to develop the frame, because we didn't really want to hold anything back. But so that goes into the idea of how we lay up the part and the types of carbon fiber we use for the part.
Well, quickly, let's track back a little. When did carbon fiber enter the cycling industry?
It's
been a while.
I think you can date it into the late 80s. I mean, the mid 90s is when it was like a thing, mm-hmm. like it was big. I mean, you started getting like, for me, like carbon fiber was the mecca of it was like, you know, 96 games was like, you know, GT superbikes, things like that was the highlight of it.
Because you started making aluminum and then we segued into carbon fiber.
Yeah, we did. So we started in 2000 with aluminum. And at the time, I mean, you couldn't getting into composites was very difficult.
Expensive.
It's very expensive, very difficult. Because, I mean, one, getting access to material is hard. CNC machines in order to produce molds is really difficult. I mean, construction is really hard. It's not a cheap thing to get into. Mm-hmm. It's scaled down a lot now. And the technology that's accessible to you now is, I mean, the stuff that we're using now, we didn't have 10 years ago. So it wasn't really, it was very difficult to do then.
Right. So in a general area, I guess, what are the benefits of using carbon fiber? And what do you feel are the downfalls of using carbon fiber in the industry?
So, I mean, the benefits of carbon is you have a very lightweight and strong material. It's very light. It's very strong. It's also very customizable. You can tailor the characteristics mm-hmm. of the material really well. Because, I mean, like Courtney was saying, it's a fabric. So anywhere the grain or like the direction of the fiber goes is your strength. So anywhere that it's perpendicular to the direction of the fiber is its weak point. So it's a non-isotropic material. So meaning that it doesn't have equal strengths in all, you know, angles. So X, Y, and Z, it's not equal, like aluminum or steel would be. So given that, that's a really big plus in bicycles, because we can tailor the riding characteristics, the stiffness exactly where we need it, and then no extra material where we don't need it. Now, where that becomes a weakness is if you just look at some basic simulations and you can figure out your loads and forces, you think it's really simple where you need strength and where you don't, but you don't realize that everything is connected to each other and you have these massive assemblies that are all moving that all have loads and forces acting on it. Mm-hmm. And that becomes much more complicated to figure that out. So like one of the problems is if you don't do it properly, you're more prone to like cracking. Your frame is prone to cracking because you're pushing the envelope of weight. And if you're running primarily unidirectional carbon, which is what a lot of people in the industry use, mm-hmm. There's nothing holding it together in the axis where the material isn't. So if you have an impact, it's more prone to crack. I mean, it's definitely one of the downsides of it in the super lightweight form. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, benefits, like I said, it was tailoring it. Mm-hmm. Another downfall of it is that to do it properly, it's expensive and complicated. So when you get lesser quality composite frames, you don't always reap the benefits of the composite.
Right.
So,
and just even on the consumer side, as someone who owns a carbon fiber bike, just the housekeeping of it, keeping a carbon fiber bike, yeah. You drop it, it's the breaking points are much
it's
easier. As we do carbon repair sometimes.
Yeah. So, for sure.
Someone, Joe Schmo, is like, hey, I accidentally ran my vacuum into it and now I have a crack.
Right. And that kind of comes back to the point of like the way you do your layup and the way the materials are set up on the bike are more, you know, prone. Now, a carbon frame will take an impact in general much better than an aluminum frame or even a steel frame, because it will disperse the load very easily because it's a material.
Right.
Because it's a fabric, and that fabric is woven together or connected together, so it disperses that load very efficiently. Now, if the fibers are only going in one direction and there's no reinforcement in the other direction, that energy that transfers through it is actually what causes the crack.
Right.
And the other thing about carbon is that most people don't realize it does not take abrasion well.
Right. That's what you've always told me before I started working here, is it took impact well, but not abrasion. And I always thought, well, you're still a goner, because even if you crash and you have impact, your bike's going to skid across the street.
It can. Sometimes you hit it. I mean, like, you were the one that skids across the street. So the bike doesn't, but it does not take impact. Like, we've had some other applications outside of the bike industry, and it was like people want to do things like skid guard pieces and add a carbon. It's like, dude, it's just such a sacrificial piece. It's not going to take it well. Not as well as like, you know, like a steel or aluminum or, you know, stainless steel piece would take. But anyways, it does not take abrasion well.
Okay. So then let's talk about quickly a little bit of the different types of carbon that are used, because it's a fabric and it can come dry, or you can purchase it already pre-impregnated with epoxy or wet lays.
Yep.
So explain those differences and the uses for each.
Yeah. So you have, there's Courtney's right. There's two different ways you typically get your fabric. You either get it dry or you get it pre-impregnated. So if you get the material dry, what you're doing is you're going to be mixing your epoxy system on its own, or your matrix, whatever you're using. You're going to use your matrix separately, mix it, and then apply the fabric dry onto a part and then or onto your mold and then saturate it with that epoxy. There's a couple ways you can do it. You can do what's called a wet lay, which you basically saturate the fabric and then lay it onto the mold. And that's really common to be done, especially in the automotive, like when you're doing like spoilers and parts like that. Even in bikes, a lot of people still do that. You can also do what's called infusion molding, where you basically vacuum everything dry and then under vacuum introduce epoxy. Mm-hmm. That's a system that we used to use quite a bit for a lot of our early majors and some of our aero bar systems and even some of our bikes that we used to do. We used to do some infusion molding on some of our parts.
And what did you feel were the benefits of that because of the angles of like the handlebars?
The angles.
So that the vacuum got it and all the little creases? The epoxy?
For sure. But also there's inherent, I mean, you're going to start getting into like really nitty gritties, but in infusion, the nice thing is that you don't introduce air to the system. So the system is completely vacuumed, mm-hmm. and then you introduce the epoxy. Mm-hmm. So you get much less epoxy or matrix inside your laminate. So you get a much stronger laminate. It's also easier if you're going to be mixing different types of materials, like different types of reinforcements. Infusion molding is a little bit easier to do. You can also batch things in infusion molding. So you could run like maybe one or two parts simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And you have more time for the layup. So there's lots of benefits and pros to either, but it's also more technical and more difficult to do. So you need much higher technical ability to do it. Mm-hmm. And if you get a little leak, it really sucks.
Yeah.
Because it happens.
Yes. Finding the leak is a fun game that we like to play here sometimes.
Yeah, especially in the big parts. We've done some really big parts and, oh my God, yeah. And you can't, in infusion molding, you cannot have a leak.
Right.
It has to be fully vacuum sealed and you have to monitor and track that. So you have to data log all that.
Right.
To make sure you have a good part.
So let's talk about pre-impregnated carbon with epoxy already introduced.
So this is the system what most people are using in production. And so that is dry fabric that is basically pressed in epoxy and then flash frozen. So you basically stop the reaction of the epoxy system. And that way you don't have to worry about laying it and you have the perfect amount of epoxy and fiber ratio, mm-hmm. which is really important. And then the benefits is, so you can also, so there's like the viscosity of the, well, obviously matrices are primarily liquid that turn into a solid. And so the viscosity changes based on the temperature. So when you ramp, so prepregs are cured with heat. Mm-hmm. So you put them in at room temperature and then you ramp them up to anywhere from 250 to 350 degrees. And then you set them for anywhere from 30 minutes to, 4 hours at that temperature. Mm-hmm. And then the part's cured and then you cool it down and you have a finished part. The cool thing with prepreg systems is if you're really dial in your materials, you can increase your pressure of your part with the viscosity in relationship to the curing, the TG of the matrix and the viscosity of the matrix so that you can get the perfect laminate compaction that you can get. So you mm-hmm. can actually just pressurize the system and then have the epoxy or whatever the matrix is bleed into the part perfectly, get that surface finish just right, get the right amount of bleed out and just get a really nice part.
Right.
And the thing with prepreg systems like that is you can just do it the same every single time.
Yeah, and it's kind of ease of use. It seems like it's an easier material to work with and drape,
also
for
because,
me at least, when I'm laying up.
Yeah, well, also the thing is because there's that epoxy system that's already, or that matrix that's already in the material, mm-hmm. it kind of sticks together. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't just like fall apart like dry material does.
Yeah.
So it's really nice. I mean, there's some limitations because you start getting into problems of like what material you can get and mixing materials and epoxy matrix systems that are compatible with each other. And it's just, there's a whole nother layer of complexity to it.
Yeah. It's all messy.
It is.
So let's discuss how we use carbon specifically in our RF20.
Yep.
What do we use on this frame?
So we use, there's a couple different types of carbon fiber in the fabric orientation realm. Mm-hmm. So there's what we call unidirectional carbon fiber, which means that all the fibers are going in one direction. So kind of like, like your hair. coming, you know, draping off of your head. It's just, it's all going in one direction, or usually it's going one direction.
You obviously haven't seen my hair this morning, but.
but yeah, the idea is it's all going in one direction. It flows. Mm-hmm. Then you have woven materials, which is typically in either plain weave or twill, which is basically just, you know, like
cross-stitched.
Yeah, like a cross-stitch type thing. It looks like a knitted, you know, blanket. Mm-hmm. That style. And then you have, well, there's some variations of that. And then you have chop, that's micro chops and long chops, which is basically short pieces of carbon fiber that are cut together and kind of like a mesh. Mm-hmm. And then you have something that's called a bidirectional braided sleeve, which is essentially a Chinese finger trap.
Right.
That's essentially what it looks like.
I think most people know what that is.
Yeah. So that's basically how that works. And that's done on a loom and they spin it. Anyways, it's very interesting. So we use a combination of materials here. So we use bidirectional braided sleeves a lot. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of advantages to that. We also use a unidirectional. And when we talk about unidirectional, we're usually talking about a spread toe, standard or high modulus material, sometimes ultra high modulus, depending on the layup for a customer.
Mm-hmm. And ultra high modulus, you're talking about because for people who want weight savings.
Weight savings and stiffness. So the high modulus, basically you're talking about the tensile strength of the material. Mm-hmm. So the higher the modulus, the higher the tensile strength.
I'm talking about your hardcore racers who put a lot of strength when they're riding.
Yeah, for sure. That and also people that want, like you said, very stiff, very snappy, and very lightweight. The problem is as you get into those higher and higher modulus, you get more a more brittle frame. The frame becomes much more brittle, so it doesn't absorb vibration as well. It transfers it more. It's more like it's closer to glass. Mm-hmm. So, and I say glass, I mean like a glass panel, not like fiberglass.
Right.
But yeah, so we use unidirectional and is our reinforcement for our stiffener. And then we use a 20 millimeter and like 30, 40 millimeter short strand materials for building up bulk in areas where we're trying to get a more isotropic property out of the material. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at like load cases like bearing joints, dropout joints.
So for the joints, you use more of the short strands.
Yeah, joints where we have things like
dropouts,
axles, dropouts, brake mounts,
mounting zones,
anything that's mounting where you have like a screw or some sort of loading capacity. You want short fiber strands because you want to be able to take that material, that load, and dissipate it quickly in all directions. And then you want to have the correct substrate behind it or with it that's going to carry that load where it needs to go. Mm-hmm. Now, the advantages of bidirectional sleeves is, if you think about it, it's kind of like a corkscrew going around a part. So when you have a load that's transferred from one side to the other side, it travels a very long distance to get to the other side, meaning that that has more time to absorb vibration and impacts. So it does really well for like having that really nice smooth ride. And also it does really well for that. It also does really well on impact. And also any sort of like, I say impact, like, I mean, rocks hitting
a curb.
hitting a curb, dropping your frame. It carries that load much, much better.
Right.
It also has an incredible amount of torsional strength. Mm-hmm. So there's some pros and cons. There's some pros there. The con, you get a little bit of added weight. You are taking that material out and spiraling it, so you have more material.
Right.
And to take the same distance, it requires more material to do it.
And we're not Predator. I don't feel like Predator Cycling is like, we're making the lightest bike possible.
No.
We're trying to make a efficient and strong bike.
Yeah.
That is light, but also
we talked about on the last podcast, it's the balancing act of trying to thread that needle
right.
to get that right balance. Something we talked about in the past was this concept of total efficiency. There's a point where you get too light and you start saving weight everywhere and it doesn't do you any benefit. Like you actually are hurting yourself. It's like you got so light that okay, now you're sacrificing ride quality, which means that you're not carrying your speed over bumps and bad sections of the road as well to go as fast, or it doesn't corner as well, or it doesn't descend as well. It starts chattering. So I mean there's limits to everything. Mm-hmm. So balancing that. And I think the braided system on our bike is it gives it a lot of there's a lot of pluses to it. At the same time, we use unidirectional
to reinforce
and stiffen up the bike where we need it.
Right. But the braided sleeves actually, just for a finish look on as the last cosmetic layer, I feel like makes it look.
Oh, it looks really good.
Yeah, especially with our molding system and the pressure we're getting. Oh. It's just.
Yeah, you get a really nice finish.
It's pretty.
It is.
If you choose not to paint your bike.
Yeah, if you choose not to paint it, it's definitely pretty.
You just know underneath that paint, it's still pretty on the inside.
Yeah, for sure. It also gives you a really nice uniform compaction around the part. So you get a really good uniform wall thickness where you need it. And that's really nice. Or with unidirectional, it's very difficult because you're dealing with overlaps. So with braided systems, it's better. Now, if you were listening to our other podcast where we were talking about that the fact that the front triangle is a monocoque front triangle and it's built off of a mandrel, and we're using bidirectional braided sleeves, for those of you that are composite people, that is, I think, is, I'm pretty proud of that fact. It makes it very complicated to make the frame. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why it took us so long to figure everything out. It's a cool construction methodology on how to put it together.
Right. So let's talk about epoxy systems.
Yes.
We use a medium to high prepreg flow system.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if that's correct.
Yeah.
You
so
correct
we
me.
No. Yeah, we do. We use a slightly higher it's got a little higher epoxy content than fiber content than most prepregs. It's a little heavy on the epoxy side.
Epoxy to fiber. And what
fiber ratio
is that for? Flow management.
So there's a couple reasons. One of the reasons we're not going to go into, because it's kind of proprietary to us. But one of the big reasons is because we're actually, so there's different types of molds that are out there, and most molds are essentially a vented mold, which means that you are pressurizing the part from the inside and the outside of the part is actually exposed to essentially ambient pressure. So meaning that you're pressing it on one side and there's a place for the air to escape.
Mm-hmm.
And then the air escapes and the epoxy escapes with that air and you press out the excess epoxy.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've kind of taken it a little bit farther. So what we do is we have I would call it a semi-sealed mold. So it at ambient temperature, when the mold is at ambient temperature and up to a certain degree, the mold is vented. So their air is allowed to escape as the pressure builds.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we get to a certain point, it stops. And then we fully pressurize the system. And we control that on a ramp schedule. We have a whole schedule that we figured out. And thank you to Ansys Mechanical for helping us simulate all of that and figure it all out. And we basically figure out that schedule, and then we close off the mold at the right time so that we can get all the air out and still have a little epoxy and then have a bleed zone for the epoxy, and then we get a really, really good compacted finish.
Right, and so you mentioned Ansys.
Yes.
Quickly, I don't know if we've mentioned them before. I think we have, but Ansys is a company that...
Ansys is the end all of simulation for most parts.
The
holy grail of simulation. There you go.
Okay.
And yeah, so we use Ansys Mechanical.
So you were talking about our pressure heat press methodology.
Yeah.
Other companies, not just bicycle, but in industry of carbon fiber, they use like closed clamshell mold techniques.
Yes. Yeah.
Explain how that's different and how we ramp our thermal properties and how Ansys assists in that.
Yeah.
Early on in simulation.
Oh, for sure. So we use essentially a clamshell. We use a modified clamshell, but a clamshell basically means that you have both sides. You can have multiple sides, parts of a mold. But when the mold is closed, the outside surface of the part is all solid and rigid aluminum or steel, whatever mm-hmm. you're doing. So you get that part finish. It's, I'd say, 99% of the bike industry is all clamshell molds. Mm-hmm. That's what pretty much everyone does. And then the question was towards, an Ansys and how simulation. Okay.
Well, cause we use more of a pressure heat press, semi clamshell hybrid. So
there's a couple. Okay. So there's a couple different ways we do that. Clamshell molds are processed. You can either process them in a press, a platen press, where you have two big metal plates that push against it and heat up the mold. Or you can throw it into an oven. A lot of people do batch ovens. So you'll throw four or five molds into an oven and then heat it up, and process it that way. You can also, if you're doing a modified clamshell or an open mold, you can actually run vacuum and throw it into an autoclave. Now, because coming back to our concept that we actually vent and then close our mold, we do all of that through, well, we have a complicated control system that controls the mold, but we also have a main contributing factor to that is heat. It's heat driven. So for us, we have to simulate it. So we have multiple types of materials inside of our mold and our mandrel systems that are made of different types of materials that all expand at different rates. So we have to basically figure out how that expansion works, how the flow of the epoxy works, and then compact that into a part and then simulate it so we can actually figure out how fast we need to ramp it, at what rate we need to ramp it at, how long we need to hold it at what temperature for, how much pressure that the mold has to be under in our press, and then when we need to vent and close and what we need to do with vacuum and air pressures.
And the rate of the cool down. I'm just reminded of our previous episode of our failure of our son's push bike.
Yes.
Because I don't know if you simulated it.
No.
Okay. Well, that explains why it completely imploded on itself.
I didn't simulate the molding process.
Okay.
Because, yeah.
So this is important. That's a prime example of why it's important in our actual products and not our son's push bike.
Yeah, right. I simulated the push bike's also set up for a course that I talk about. We talk about simulation, and in the course I don't cover simulation for molding because it's not part of the course. It was getting too in depth. So yeah, I simulated for the product itself and not the simulation of how the product is molded.
So there's a bunch of science and tech behind all of this. I have a very, very, not a very good grasp of. But
you process it all. I mean, you're the one that actually.
I just hope when people buy our RF20 or any of our products, they just know how much time was spent prior to the product, but even like
the platform it's built on.
The platform it's built on. There's a process behind it that to me is so complicated.
Well, it's not simple. I may have overcomplicated it to a certain degree.
Yes, we make bikes, but I feel we are a tech company.
Yeah, well, I think in the previous episode we were talking about how we have different manufacturing platforms, and that's really what this is built on, and that's really what the RF20 is. It is a really cool bike, in my opinion.
But it's also a showpiece of technology used behind it.
For sure.
Simulation.
I mean, and that's the thing is like. You know, I've done a couple talks recently in the last couple months about simulation and, you know, and hardware accelerations and GPU systems and stuff. And it just, I can't emphasize enough. I mean, we are so fortunate that we were able to have an amazing software package and hardware package at our disposal. I mean, that's amazing. But on top of that, we're able to introduce that so early on into the workflow. And that's what makes it a game changer.
Like, and I think that makes us stand out a little bit from other companies. Because we have an arm.
that is a plus and a minus.
It is plus and a minus because, I mean, obviously you are, you know, an encyclopedia of cycling knowledge, but you have a grasp on the technology side.
Yeah.
And you have this seamless workflow that you use all up there in that noggin of yours.
Yeah, I like it. To me, it's a massive puzzle and I really enjoy it. And I can't emphasize enough how lucky we are that we have. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've called support for like different software packages.
Oh my gosh. I just want to just apologize to the support and customer service of basically any other company that we team with. Because
I'm sorry.
ARM takes advantage. If you offer any sort of help or assistance or service, he's going to call you. And you better block off a good 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah, yeah. I have a lot of questions.
You do. You have a lot of questions.
No, and that's the thing. But that's the thing. Like with some of these companies that we work with, I mean, the amount of support that you get is so meaningful because you can actually leverage the tech. So, I mean, that's what we've been able to do with ANSYS. I mean, I emphasize ANSYS a lot because it's the simulation side of it has been a massive game changer for us. And without that and our hardware acceleration, the RF20, I don't think would have come to fruition.
Oh, yeah.
Or at least to the magnitude, to the ability that we were able to.
Right.
It's a game changer.
Great. Is there anything that you want to add about the amazing topic of carbon fiber?
There's a lot I want to add. I don't think we have time.
No, we don't.
And I don't want to bore everybody.
We're going to get going. But just recent news for our customers or listeners, look for our website to have a lot of updates coming here in the next couple weeks. Mm-hmm. We have a big refresh to the RF20 page as we start adding the actual geometry charts and more technical information.
Yeah, we're going to give quite a bit. And I think we're also going to be adding in the next couple weeks, we're going to be adding some, for people that have more questions about the RF20 mm-hmm. in specific, we're going to have a booking feature on there. So you can book some time to talk to us.
Talk to you.
Talk to me.
No one wants to talk to me about it.
No, they might. They might want to ask explanation of what it does.
For sure. It's been in a pre-order state for quite a while, and we're finally launching it and going to production here soon. So we have a lot more information to share.
Yeah. So
what to look forward to on future podcasts, I think we're going to touch on another big product update that we plan on working on here in Q3 and Q4 of this year and getting relaunched, and that is the major handlebars.
Yep.
I feel like that is what people really want from us.
Yeah.
And we definitely have put it on a huge pause, and we're going to get back to it now that we have worked on the system that we worked. The RF20 really worked out a lot of kinks in the process that is going to apply directly to the new major production.
And it's I'd like to emphasize, it's the major family of bars.
It's the major family of bars.
It's not just the Pilot.
We're
bringing the whole family of Pilots back. I mean, the majors back.
Yeah.
So we've heard a lot of the people's requests.
The people want it.
The people want it. We get emails weekly, daily. I apologize for not doing it earlier. The RF20, the platform the RF20 is built on is carrying over to pretty much everything we have. And the major is definitely one of them.
Great. Okay, well, let's wrap it up. We thank you for choosing to take some time with us and look forward to future breakaways. I'll try my hardest to put any mentions on our news section on predatorcycling.com. Also, look for us on Instagram and LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, and in person here in Tennessee. Aram, let's get back to work. So we ask our listeners to please share, like, and subscribe. We're available on all major streaming platforms. Thanks for listening. Have a good one, and find some time to break away.